evolution of therapeutics. And also I just realized as I was traveling that probably I shouldn't have brought Adam and Eve to this forum, and that's because although they are our old ancestors, so it's more symbolic, but I think all of us are scientists. This is a hardcore scientific forum, and scientists don't believe in anything that has no evidence, and there is no evidence for existence of Adam and Eve, but there is good evidence for existence of Homo sapiens. So let's say I want to talk on evolution of therapeutics from HS Homo sapiens to us. Okay, so before anything else, there's a standard disclaimer that whatever I'm going to present or talk or show, they are purely my views and they are not views of my organization. So this is the Homo sapien who existed 200,000 years ago. Average lifespan of just about 25, 30, 40 years, half of what we have currently. And there is evidence. So now onwards, whatever I'm going to talk is all evidence based, nothing speculative, imaginative. So he also suffered from diseases like osteoarthritis, spondylitis, probably because of heavy load of stones that they used to carry, transport from one place to other place. They also suffered from infections, and obviously they looked for cure, and the cure or the remedy was obtained from nature, something that was very easily available to him, such as soil, minerals, or remains of humans, and mainly predominantly plants, the bark, leaves, seeds, flowers, etc. As against this, the medicines that are available to modern man today, they are extremely refined. They may be chemical drugs, chemical medicines, or biological medicines. And so essentially this evolution that I'm referring to, that is from prehistoric times till today, it's basically its journey from empiricism to refinement. So you can clearly see a link. Even our therapeutics, very early therapeutics around 1874, they were, till that time they were purely plant product based. Salicylic acid, morphine, quinine, all are plant products. Till we reached antibiotic era, that's when the microbial origin of disease was established. And then actually this is the start of mechanism based drug discovery effort, a very formal drug discovery effort, RDD, rational drug discovery. And this is where Western pharma engaged them into it. And then it continued, it even continues now. So most of this progress, most of this evolution of therapeutics happened in last about 150 years or so because of the scientific disciplines that evolved during this period. Otherwise, science existed for something like 2000 years, but in a very spiritual form or a very philosophical form. Last 500 years, science has existed as science or modern science, but last 150, 200 years, lot of specialties, super specialties have evolved which enabled this kind of drug discovery effort globally. So next slide, it may look complex, but it's a very simple slide. And if you look from top to bottom, it actually shows how different therapeutics, chemical entities, proteins, antibodies, and now cell therapeutics, how they evolved with time, and they were supported or enabled by specific scientific disciplines that evolved along with them or before them, the kind of therapeutics that they delivered and the kind of diseases that existed. So this is very important. These medicines served the needs of society when the infectious diseases dominated. Subsequently, deficiency diseases, these were under control. So there was diabetes, cancers, viral infections where there was deficiency of insulin, interferon, interleukins, erythropoietin. And this is where molecular biology came into existence. Around 72, Paul Berg first made a recombinant DNA. Then in Boyer's lab, recombinant insulin was made. And from there onwards, a lot of improvement happened till actually launch of insulin happened in 84. So this period predominantly all these sciences evolved and it led to commercialization of biotechnology. And these served the needs of curing deficiency diseases. And lastly, degenerative diseases, which is currently prevailing, neurodegenerative diseases, osteoarthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, where there is degeneration of cartilage, neurons, So these medicines are not of great use here because something is already damaged and it cannot be corrected, it has to be replenished or restored. So that's where these therapeutics are relevant to these needs. So the simple message here is to today's clinicians and today's patients, there are a lot of therapeutic platforms available, from chemical drugs to biologics to therapeutics. And I think pharma industry overall, although I work for Glenmark, I speak on behalf of the global pharma industry, it has done a great job of catering to needs of the society to cure diseases that were prevalent at that time. And this research is never ending, as it continues even today. And just for your information, what's the value chain, how this research happens, or what is the modality here. So the blue part or the green arrow shows duration for which the preclinical work happens. Once a company decides it wants to discover drug for, say, diabetes, so the preclinical work is all done without human involvement, without human trials. So it's all work done in test tubes, without cells, with proteins, with cells, with animals, but no human component. And it may take 3 to 5 years for a company to come out with a compound, I won't say drug, a compound which has a potential to work or to cure human disease. Then it moves into human trials. So human trials run for 5 to 7 years. So they are phase 1, phase 2, phase 3, depending on, these are generally healthy human volunteers, just to see whether the experimental therapeutic is tolerated or it is toxic or unsafe. And then it gradually moves to phase 2, which is small number of patients suffering from that specific disease. Only if it works, well tolerated, it moves to phase 3, which is several thousand patients. And only if it works and well tolerated, the regulatory agency gives approval for marketing. So at every stage, there is very close interaction with the regulatory agency, which may be US FDA. If the drug is for US launch, it may be EMEA for Europe, it may be DCGI for India. So these are highly, highly regulated human trials. And even the transition of a compound from animal studies or the preclinical to clinical needs a very solid support from toxicological investigation. So there are, if one wants to test a therapeutic for 1 month, the test compound must undergo toxicological evaluation for 1 month duration at 10-fold, 20-fold, 30-fold higher doses, not at the doses at which it is going to be effective in man. This is a very, very stringent requirement, and without crossing these. So the agency every time has a very close, thorough review of the data package. The data package includes all the animal work, the chemistry, the cellular work, the toxicological studies, and then allows one to get into phase 1. So it's a long duration. If the drug discovery work starts here, if everything goes well, the drug may come out on market after 12, 13, 14 years. It may drop at any stage. So any stage the failure can happen. And look at the cost. I mean, I need not read these numbers. These are enormously high. So it's a very, very pricey research activity. Something like 10 million, 300 million and 20 million. So that kind of stakes are involved here. And besides this, it's a thoroughly multidisciplinary activity. So to decide on which target to work, where to intervene or interfere the disease pathway, there is a hardcore cell biology, molecular biology, pharmacology, immunology. To make the target clone, one needs biochemistry, molecular biology. For designing the compounds, which have to be novel, they have to be patentable. So medicinal chemistry, synthetic chemistry, then what the drug does to the body, DMPK, toxicology, clinical sciences, formulation, stability, everything. So it's a real, truly multidisciplinary research activity. So putting these two slides together, it has a long gestation period, 10 to 12 years average, it may even go beyond this. The cost is very huge, more than $1 billion to bring drug to market from lab or bench to bedside, as they say. And there is a high risk of failure, but it's a part and parcel of the game. So everybody engaged in this game knows that failure is going to be more common than success. So everybody is engaged in the process with that mindset. Now, just looking at failures, as I said, you know, this is during preclinical evaluations, which is more common because the drug is unsafe, but this is fine because this is detected very early on in the process, so not big commercial losses. If the drug fails in phase 1 trials, again the reason mainly is safety. It is not well tolerated by healthy individuals. There is no efficacy assessment in phase 1. It's mainly safety, whether the drug is safe to man. But as you move forward, as you start looking at efficacy, whether the drug is anti-inflammatory, whether the drug is anti-diabetic, or whether it reduces pain in osteoarthritis. So most of the failures happen during these trials because there is no efficacy. And these are very expensive failures because company has already invested several million dollars, several hundreds of million dollars, and then, so there is a common saying that fail early, fail cheap is better. Earlier it fails, you know, less financial losses for the company. Unfortunate, but yes. So that's one thing. Now why this failure? When I am saying that, you know, it's already known if the drug fails because of no efficacy, why is it not factored in? You know, why is it not taken care during the start? So typically any drug discovery project starts on a hypothesis. Okay, the hypothesis is that modulation of certain element, certain protein, certain receptor, certain cells, either you ask them to shut up or you ask them to do more work. The belief is that they will correct the disease using a signal from small molecules. So this whole hypothesis is based on a lot of evidence which comes from academic studies, published studies in animals, cells, human clinical trials. So this is a typical, you know, single cell, single pathway at any given point of time. It's so complex. I'm not going to read into it. That's not the intention. But we have millions of such cells and there are millions of such pathways operating, and there is a circadian rhythm, there is day-night cycle, there is metabolic signal. So based on all this, it is so complex that this is like a haystack, and which mechanism could be a disease driver, finding out that is like finding a needle in the haystack. So many a times the programs fail because this needle identified is not correct despite of rich scientific rationale and rich scientific evidence. Okay, now past 5-10 years, there is another good realization that all complex diseases, they are not simple. This is what we were just discussing, myself and Ullas, that complex diseases are always heterogeneous. So the diseases which run for years, if you have 100 patients, they will have similar symptomatology, but the underlying cause of the disease is going to be likely to be different in different patients. So which is shown here in this example, these are the patients, so every color is one mechanism. They all look similar as far as the symptoms are concerned, but the causes of diseases are different. So if they are all treated with one medicine, only small population will respond, and overall in the trial it will come out as negative. So patient stratification, you know, which is again not an easy job. I can very easily stand here and say, okay, one has to stratify the patients, but to do that, one needs very accurate diagnostics. So which patient has which mechanism, and accordingly offer the therapy. So this is almost what is personalized medicine or precision medicine. And this is a classic example of liver cancer. So these are all therapies available for liver cancer, but liver cancer could be because of EGFR mutation, ALK mutation, ROS1 mutation, MET mutation, VEGF mutation. And this is only 45% of the patients. Rest 55%, the causes are not known, so they are not going to respond to any of these therapies. So this is again a precision medicine. So heterogeneous nature of diseases is one of the reasons why these drug fails, and only the failure tells that this drug is not right for this patient. It cannot be reverse engineered most of the time. Asthma is again another example. This is more probably all of you know, and some of your relatives, friends could have this. And when it is mild or moderate, most of the patients respond to steroids. You must have seen them inhaling some sprays. These are steroids or bronchodilators, to which, you know, which work well for them. But as the disease gets severe, it starts getting into different endotypes. So some asthmatics have very high IgE. They have a different treatment called Xolair. Some of them have more eosinophils. They have, this is a very recent, I think few months ago this treatment got approved, anti-IL-5 antibody. Some of them have TH2 driven asthma, some have neutrophilic asthma. So these people still don't have cure for severe asthma, and there could be many more whose mechanisms we don't know. So, I mean, you can imagine there are how many factors that need to be built in when the research program starts to identify or to discover a drug to a specific disease. One has to take into account which target, which cells, which patient population, what to look at, what to design. And above all that, there has to be a patent. The compound has to be patentable. So it's like a cart, you know, which is overburdened. So this drug discovery cart is actually overburdened. The cart puller is exasperated. This is a typical description of a drug discovery research program. And no wonder if the cart actually topples. And that's why it's openly accepted that this kind of research has very, very low success rate. So I'm not here just to tell you what are the hurdles, what are the difficulties, what are the challenges, because every coin has two sides. So now let's look at the second side of the coin. Despite all this, despite so many drug failures, so much financial losses, there are companies who have made billions of dollars from drugs that have worked. So they continue to do good research work. And imagine at this juncture, the global pharma industry spends something like $150 billion per year on new drug discovery research. So with all those efforts, it's not totally a journey in the dark, but there is light at the end of the tunnel. So I'm very happy to share this slide, you know, after talking of all bad things and negative things, that these are all approvals that have come in last 10 years. If you look at the recent 22 new drugs got approved, last year 45 new drugs. So new is altogether new, drugs which are working by altogether new mechanism to treat diseases which have no cure. And I think every launch, every approval, at least 40% of these drugs are to patients who are otherwise dying in the absence of treatment. So this has really given life to millions of patients and given good quality of life to them, which otherwise had no cure. So these are some of the highlights of global pharmaceutical research achievement. So I don't know how many of this audience is biologists, if you can just raise hands, just for my understanding. Okay, so I would say about 50%. So I'll still stay on the surface. I'll not deep dive into too much into biology or science, so that everybody has some take home from these slides. So this is just one example. I have chosen to walk you through the complete value chain, how a basic science, you know, which is published from somebody like Dr. Ullas's lab or any other lab. Of course, that's one piece of evidence, but there are many such evidences are put together, and then pharmaceutical research starts until a market launch of the molecule. So this is a disease, psoriasis. It's a very prevalent disease. About 3% is prevalence in US. And it's a skin disease, chronic skin disease, mild, moderate, severe, whatever. And there are some treatments available. They are suboptimal. Some cause neutropenia, some cause blood pressure increase, and the efficacy is modest. So it's not a phenomenal effect that, you know, benefit that they give to patients. So pharma industries are trying to find better drugs, you know, which can really make life of these patients. Now, these patients are not going to die of psoriasis. It's not a fatal disease like cancer. They survive, but they have very bad quality life. They have physical disabilities. They have psychological disabilities. 50% of them are depressed because of this appearance they have. They don't socialize. They don't go to work. So absenteeism from work. So a lot of confounding factors. So for a pharma industry, the work starts from understanding what's happening to patient's skin. So typically these skin biopsies, they show this kind of plaques, you know, hyperproliferation of skin cells. The skin cells divide and they form a raised surface, and then it starts scaling off. And in this process, the nerves get activated, so it becomes extremely itchy. There is thickened skin, flaky skin, dry skin. And that makes life of patients very difficult. So with so many years of research from academia, from clinical sciences, from translational sciences, animal studies, now it's very well understood what happens in the skin, what havoc. It really goes crazy. So because half our biologists, I would just give a simple summary there. variety of immune cells, dendritic cells, TH2, TH17, neutrophils, fibroblasts, and there are many factors that they make. This is a long list of cytokines, long list of chemokines, growth factors. So it becomes a very crazy, everything is becoming more, unlike which is very controlled in a healthy individual. So all these become potential targets. So one always wonders what to target. If you stop production of IL-6, will the patients be benefited? So pharma industries try to make antibodies to TNF-alpha which are approved, which do work, but efficacy is modest, safety is not so good. So around 2005, I remember I was in Paris attending this World Inflammation Congress. 80% of the posters were on this TH17 biology. This was newly recognized then. This IL-17 is produced by TH17 cells, which are, you know, majorly present in the psoriatic skin. And 50% of oral presentations in the meeting were also on TH17. So industries thought maybe target TH17 because they make these chemicals, and they keep signaling keratinocytes to divide till, you know, it becomes a very aberrant skin. So these are the hypothesis now. So this is the haystack, and the hypothesis is whether IL-17 signaling can be targeted, and by doing that whether one can have good efficacy or good treatment for psoriasis. So is this a needle in haystack? So then a lot of evidence comes from animals. So these are mice, and these you can develop psoriasis in mice by treating them with this iamic, this is one chemical. So when normal mice are treated with this, they develop red skin, scaling, everything like a human psoriatic patient. But when you knock off this gene, they are protected. So the IL-17 knockout genes don't show any redness, don't show scales, don't show thickness. Even in histology, the epithelial lining is very normal, like normal animals, much reduced thickness. So this supported hypothesis. Second evidence comes from actual studies where psoriatic mice are treated with anti-IL-17 antibodies. So you can neutralize IL-17, and these mice, as you can see, this scaling and redness is completely reduced. Even histology, if you look at the psoriatic mice versus antibody treated mice, there is complete cure of the skin thickening. So this is again a very strong support to hypothesis that targeting IL-17 could be a good idea to get a good treatment for psoriasis. Moving on, this is encouraging data, but we know man is not mouse, mouse is not man. Although the animal data is encouraging, there is no guarantee that this will hold true for man. So next piece of evidence required is actually human studies, where scientists looked at the skin homogenate and lesions and showed that IL-17 levels actually go up. So there are two clinical studies where there is increased IL-17, almost like 40 patients. Another study, they also showed that in patients' skin layers, these IL-17 producing cells go up. So this again supported very well that IL-17 could be a major disease driver, and its blockade could potentially attenuate psoriasis in man. So what next is only showing this in man. Take psoriatic patients, treat them with anti-IL-17 antibody. This is what Novartis did. So these are results from their phase 3 study. So they made these antibodies, they ran through the whole value chain of 10-12 years, make antibodies, test in animals, toxicology, phase 1, phase 2. So I am just flashing these results of phase 3 study. This is a severe psoriatic patient treated with antibodies for 4 weeks. And you can see there is a miraculous cure. Excuse me. So the clinical endpoints are measured in the form of PASI score, psoriasis activity and severity index. So here the patient straight away becomes from severe to mild. So not just this, but they also showed by looking at the skin IL-17 and cells before and after treatment that there is statistically significant reduction in number of those cells which make IL-17. And this is something which is very, very fascinating. This is overall improvement in the patients over 12 weeks. As you can see, first week itself, the patients start showing benefit compared to the placebo. But what is interesting is about 80% of patients show 50% improvement. 45% patients show 75% improvement. 20% patients show 90% improvement. And this is first time in the history of, you know, drug discovery that any therapeutic has shown this kind of effect, that complete clearing of skin, complete eradication of disease. Although in 20% population, it's a big, big achievement. So this is one excellent example how a successful drug discovery program starts, shapes up, and eventually results in a therapeutic that's available to patients. So this is again a summary of how basic biology, this IL-17 was cloned first in 1993. Then around 2005, it was discovered that it is produced by Th17 cells and all these things. And this was the time when it was perceived as a therapeutic target. And then Novartis, Amgen, Lilly, all these big companies started their drug discovery research programs. So start of program, phase 1, phase 2 and phase 3. So I showed you the results from phase 3, based on which US FDA actually approved these drugs. So these are really, really serving needs of these patients. So I think most of the time I talked in a global context, what Lilly is doing, what Western Pharma is doing, $1 billion, $1 million. So let's just look at where India Incorporated stands as far as this high tech expensive research is concerned, whether we are even aware of what is all this, where do we stand, you know, our competitiveness in this field. So let me take you back to my first slide, not physically, but if you recollect, Western Pharma started drug discovery way back in 1950, almost 70-80 years ago. And the pharma industry existed 100 years ago in Western world, as against in India, till 1970 there was no pharmaceutical sector at all. Most of the medicines were imported, and that's how our medical needs were served. 70s, some early pharmaceuticals appeared, Alembic, Sarabhai. There was no sign of research as such. So we got into research only when India decided to enforce product patent. That was in 2005. So some companies realized that unless they have a differentiated product or a novel therapeutic, they cannot sustain in competition just selling generic drugs. So that's where very few, handful of 4-5 companies got into this drug discovery research, year 2000. So history of our drug discovery efforts is very short, just 17, 18, at the most 20 years, as compared to Western Pharma. But nevertheless, I'm happy to share that these are the companies and we are one of them. And all of us together, I mean individually, but on a national tone, there's a good progress made. So each of these have their own R&D strategy in terms of NC or NB or both, chemicals or proteins, whether to work on diabetes, metabolic disease, cancers, which therapy area, whether to sell these therapeutics whenever they appear in local market or global market, and whether to work on truly novel molecules, because these are all very important decisions for sustainability. So all these are in place. And so this is a rich IP we have created, all companies. As you can see, hundreds of patents are published, which means good work is happening, and which clearly reflects interest in therapeutic area. This is our company, inflammation, pain and respiratory, we have strong interest. Suven is one company interested in neurobiology, Cadila metabolic diseases. So there are very handful of players, but I think they know what is this game. So they are now, Indian Pharma are also drug discovery proficient. And so this is our pipeline, whole inclusive of all companies, just 8 players. There are about 18 compounds in phase 1 human trials, 10 compounds in phase 2 and 4 compounds in phase 3 trials, which is a lean but a quality pipeline, because if you look at the spread, it's across therapy areas. There are trials happening in oncology, inflammation, neurology, infections, metabolic diseases. So it's It's a real progress, I would say, which is made considering it's only 15-20 years of effort and considering the investments that are required here, because no pharmaceutical company in India has deep pockets to bring drug from discovery to market. No company can spare $1 billion to bring a drug on market. So there are some business models which I'll talk about. And this is our pipeline. So we also have 7 different drugs, biologics, small molecules. Most advanced is phase 2, halfway. Another one is getting ready for phase 2 and some others getting into phase 1 and all. And of course, we have a lot of discovery projects at the moment. Again, what is impressive is there are few deals happened, licensing deals, where big pharma have approached Indian companies to take their proprietary molecules. This is called as in-licensing. And this is at a good cost, where the R&D cost definitely can be recovered, the risk can be shared, and the rewards can be shared. So first is Ryzen Novartis deal in cancer program, dual PI3 kinase. Then Curadev had out-licensed their molecules to Roche in cancer. And we have made, I think, history in, I'm not boasting myself, but I think we have made a history on Indian pharma background. We cracked 7 licensing deals so far, and we got a cash inflow of $180 million through those upfronts and milestone payments. So we partnered with Forest Labs on 2 different occasions. Teijin is a Japanese company, Merck KG, American, Lilly, Sanofi is a French company in the areas of inflammation and pain. So this kind of endorses that the quality of research done by Indian pharma is at par and globally competitive. That's why MNCs come to Indian companies and get into licensing deals. And in particular, we had 2 deals with the same company on 2 occasions, twice with Forest and twice with Sanofi Aventis. So we are very flexible to get into partnerships. So this deal with Forest, one of them was early research partnership when we just had a preclinical package. Deal with Lilly was with phase 1 data, good safety and good exposures. And Merck KGA was also end of phase 1. This was end of phase 1. This was end of phase 1. So it's all depending on what the company wants, and we are open. So I don't know if there is time and interest, I can just walk you through our success story. So I explained what Lilly did, what Amgen did, and what Novartis did, how they got their molecules into clinic, what strategy, what intellectual decisions they made. So I'll just share again a top line, not get into too much details. Our one of successful, most advanced programs, I would say, in pain management, and again chronic pain coming from osteoarthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, diabetic neuropathy, post-herpetic neuralgia. All these are chronic pain conditions with no good medicines. And so this is often, I often called is that not pain management, but mismanagement. So there are cannabinoid drugs, there's morphine, which are opioids, which are very powerful analgesics, but very bad because they have a lot of side effects, hallucinations and respiratory depression, constipation, and there's a never ending list of CNS side effects. But despite that, they are given because there is no other good analgesic. Capsaicin is another topical drug which is extremely painful. It's supposed to relieve pain, but it produces intense pain when it is applied. So it is applied as a patch under local anesthesia. So it's not something easy a patient can, like, you know, popping a pill. So this is one, this is a TRPV1 receptor antagonist, and it's like, there's a old saying that you can use a thorn to remove thorn. So it's a painful product used to suppress pain, so not very welcoming product. Then gabapentin, pregabalin are calcium receptor antagonist. Again, bad drugs because they give minimal therapeutic benefit in small number of patients, and again, very large number of side effects. But these are heavily being prescribed because there is nothing else to give, to offer to the patients. So poor patients, you would appreciate what they do, they get into all these. So I don't want to criticize any of these, but they get into acupressure, acupuncture, and eventually, nothing works. So then they say enough of acupuncture, the pill was better, and the pill was actually worst. So there's actually nothing, and they really suffer, there's no remedy to cure their sufferings. So then there is lot known about basic science of pain, pain signal transmission. There are nerves, peripheral. So there is pain signal transmission from affected organ to brain through these nerves. And these nerves carry lot of receptors which are called as nociceptors. They sense pain and tell brain that look, there is a pain and you tell what to do. So these nociceptors, there are very large number of such nociceptors, and we decided to work on a specific receptor called TRPA1, transient receptor potential enkyrin type 1. So it's a big name, we can forget about it. But basically this is a protein which is a gating channel. So it can be closed on the surface of neuronal membrane. It can stay closed, and in response to environmental or extracellular stimuli, it can open. When it is open, it's called gating. So when it's open, lot of calcium gets inside the cell. And calcium is a very potent secondary messenger. It can induce lot of genes, upregulation, downregulation. So there is release of these chemicals which induce pain. So basically this receptor is involved early in pain signal translation. So our idea was to see if we block this by using small molecules, we prevent its opening and allowing calcium influx, whether that can be analgesic. So with this hypothesis we moved forward, and I'll not get into all those details, but we started this work in 2006, and there was rich evidence again from animals, knockout animals protected from pain. Then humans suffering from pain had upregulated TRPA1. Interestingly, there is a gain of function mutation in man in TRPA1, where the receptor works more, there is more calcium getting inside the cell, and these patients show aberrant pain. They show lot of pain under specific conditions. So that proves that receptor has a role in pain signal transmission. Such evidences are very crucial in initiating any drug discovery program. So we had that evidence. So we made that decision in 2006, and we designed lot of proprietary molecules, about 2000 molecules falling into 10 different chemical scaffolds. We owned a patent on those. We tested them in cell-free systems. We created recombinant cell lines expressing human, mouse, rat, TRPA1 and other TRP variants to assess selectivity. Tested them in animal models of pain where they worked very well. Then manufactured to gram scale under GMP conditions. We approached FDA. We did phase 1 trials. It came out good. Animal tox, it came out good. And safety in man, everything was good. And then we also did a proof of concept trial. We tested this in human patients suffering from diabetic neuropathic pain. And we got a good positive signal that it cured neuropathic pain. So this is just a snapshot of that. The compound is called GRC-17536. If you Google, you may find lot of publications that we made or conference presentations. So this is first in class. So we were global leaders. There was no one else in the whole world who had a TRPA1 antagonist in humans, in human trials. And we are still number one. There were some other programs that failed for different reasons. So this is potent and selective. It was orally available because oral route is always 100% compliant. People, nobody likes to get injected or, you know, get into hospital. So oral route is preferred. It was effective in animal models. It showed good safety in tox as well as healthy volunteers, and it yielded a positive. So this is a kind of milestone achieved for us. Of course, there is a long way for this compound to move to phase 2B, phase 3 and come on market. But so far, this is very encouraging piece for the whole team also. The team is motivated. So that's one of our, I would say, a small success stories that I could share with you. And these are all publications just on TRPA1, our own research data, cellular data, animal data, some reviews also. We were invited to write reviews. So these all publications on TRPA1 you will find on Google. These are all from Glenmark and my team mainly. So I think I just wanted to convey, which was even my impression during my PhD, that industrial research is very substandard. It's only to get R&D benefit from the tax benefit from government, and nothing happens. It's only, you know, some labs created. But I think now, having talked so much about it, I think it's evident that these, what we do or what pharma do, it's not just pretension of doing innovation, or it's not pretension of doing research, like this man is just pretending to be Einstein by, you know, dressing his hair like Einstein. But what we do is your real genuine research with a good intention of discovering new drug, because the philosophy of this person, we believe that we can't solve problems by using same kind of thinking that we used when the problems were created. So one has to try novel concepts, novel ideas, novel approaches, cutting edge science to come out with better medicines or differentiated products over what is already existing. Just improving what is existing is me too research, and that's not going to lead neither patients anywhere nor the clinicians anywhere. So, okay, this is just on Indian pharma. It's emerging as a strong player in drug discovery research space. And this is the research center where I work. It's a beautiful fountain to welcome you. You are all welcome to visit this. We are located in New Mumbai. About 650 scientists, one third engaged in drug discovery, one third formulation research, and one third API or process research. And Dr. Ullas has promised me he'll make it sometime soon. This is our research center in Switzerland, where all the antibody work happens, novel antibody. This is our research center in US, where our clinical team sits, our chief medical officer, clinicians, biostatistician, pharmacovigilance, etc. So they monitor our clinical trials. So you are also welcome to visit these, but at your own expense. And that's it. I really thank you for your patience. It's a long weekend, so I'm sure those weekend tasks are, or the task list is superseding scientific thought. So thank you very much. If there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer. Thank you.
How do you find this healthy volunteers to come and test your drugs?
Yes, so all these studies we don't do ourselves. We have to register, show our interest to some specific centers who are approved to do such trials. So most of our phase 1 trials on healthy volunteers are done in Europe or US, and they have these clinical CROs, contract research organizations, which all function as per the guidance of local regulatory body and CGMP practices. So it's not our work, but we need to outsource. We become the sponsors and the CRO becomes investigator. So it's a third party kind of, but again tightly regulated. Yeah, that's a very good question, and that's what we are often asked, because we talk a lot about chronic diseases and no one talks of tuberculosis, malaria, which are more prevalent in our country. So we also had one project on diarrhea, anti-diarrhea. HIV therapy introduces diarrhea. So we had a molecule in phase 3 and we out-licensed. So we also did some work on HIV-induced diarrhea. But I think pharmaceutical Lupin works on tuberculosis. And there are more these CSIR-led or NIH-led initiatives. So it's public-private partnership. It's not industry alone, because all these infectious diseases are acute. You know, if you spend $1.5 billion and you give the drug to patient only for 5 days, the industry will get bankrupted. So that cost is justified only when the treatment is for long duration. So for such diseases, there are public-private initiatives. So a lot of work is happening. Yes.
Neglected either because your market is not very lucrative or because of the reasons that you said.
Yes. So there is NIH initiative, CSIR initiative. There are many malaria, MMV, malaria venture. So they are also going on, but I didn't capture because we are not actively working on. None of the pharma industries are working.
What do they expect and what do we
Each of the?
Each of the sides.
Uh-huh.
The Indian company.
Okay.
Global
right. How is it win-win? Yeah. Right. So there are two types of such collaborations. I only talked of one where the pharmaceutical company itself is engaged in drug discovery and they have a drug discovery program, and at some stage they license out their novel molecules or proprietary molecules to big company. So now I think you need to look into the dynamics, what's happening outside India. So most of these big pharma, you must be aware, they are downsizing. You know, they have laid off jobs like anything, because doing such preclinical research in US is becoming very expensive. So they have kind of downsized the preclinical research, and these big pharma depend on small companies like us or other biotech companies to get early stage molecules, either research stage molecules or phase one. So companies like us, we do the cost sharing and risk sharing, because the drug can get into advanced trials. If it fails, the partner shares the cost. These partners also have great experience in designing clinical trials, which is itself an art and science. So Indian companies do not have great experience in designing clinical trials, which big pharma have. So when we get into partnership with Lilly or anybody else, first of all, we share the cost of developing the drug in running phase 2 trials, 2A, 2B, 3, which are expensive trials. Small company can't afford, and big companies get a drug to fill their pipelines. So that's how it's win-win. The second kind of collaboration is we have some CROs, contract research organizations in India, who don't have their in-house drug discovery program, but they just offer their services to big pharma. So there are many big pharmas who are working with Jubilant or Origin or GVK. They say, okay, we want to work on this target, you give us novel molecule. Or we have this program, you test in animal models and give us the data. So that's more like a fee for service. So these are purely working for the monetary parts. Companies like us, we make our own intellectual decisions in terms of which therapy area, which target, which molecule, what type of chemistry, oral route or inhaled route. And when we understand the molecule fully, we are ready to get into licensing deals. So it's a win-win for both. Cost sharing, reward sharing, and also it's a learning experience, because once the molecule is out-licensed, there are teams from both companies which work together jointly. So for our team, it's always a learning experience.
These clinical trials also happen in India, right? I mean,
they are sponsored trials, yeah.
How come the Indian companies don't have experience about?
No, because as I showed you, Indian drug discovery effort is only 20 years old. In 20 years, you can't have 20 molecules reaching phase 3 trials. Unlike big pharma, they have run thousands of clinical trials, thousands of molecules reaching phase 3. So it's a very tricky thing, what population to select, what endpoint, primary endpoint, secondary endpoint. There are many intricacies to clinical trial design. And we don't have infrastructure or expertise to run phase 3 trials of our own. So big pharma, when they come to India, they have their own centers, they have their own people who actually collaborate with the CRO in India in designing trials. It's not entirely done by the Indian CRO. So a lot of intellectual inputs come from the MNC. You have a question.
Yeah. So you said that the whole cycle really starts with basic science research in some way. Now, and those are the inputs to a whole cycle of things, which might end certain development of ideas, patents, maybe commercial. So what happens to the inputs that you actually receive from the public domain basic research? So, is there a connectivity there? Is there some extension of any benefits to the authors of this basic science research? How does this model,
right.
How do you disconnect this from?
No, so as I said, the evidence which I, just to make the story simple, I just showed one start point coming from academia. But there are a lot of things done on top of that to validate that this mechanism could be the right one. The original idea or the published piece of information may come from several academia. It's not just one group, one publication. Then it is a weak evidence. So it has to be strengthened by doing lot of other things. And whatever is in public domain, academia cannot claim as, you know, you give us royalties, you give us milestones. But in US, universities do that. If they have any new idea, they think that something is a potential target in some disease process, they have their own license on those, they have patents on those processes. And big pharma approach them, they pay money and take the patent. So that's not happening in India. But it's very common in US to patent something and then let the industry approach them. If not, then they can sue the industry if the patent is granted to university.
So how much is the industry that in interaction
in India? Yeah, I think currently it's just minimal. Unfortunately, it's just minimal. And I think US is world leading as far as the US academia are also drug discovery proficient, and it's something that has not happened overnight in US. It has evolved over so many decades that they invested a lot of money in generating infrastructure, scholarships, lot of expenditure investment in healthcare research, and it's a federal government, universities, public, private, all components together. Their research centers are natural resources. It's a very different ecosystem, and in India it's lacking. But I think that there has to be an initiative and not led by any facilitator. It's only a matter of industries and academia understanding each other's expectations and identifying areas of synergy, you know, and maybe create areas of synergies if they don't exist. But this interaction is a gap, and if it really gets filled, maybe we can do better work, quicker, better.
Does Denmark itself has any such interface with the academia?
Yeah, in India, yes, we had one collaborative project with Institute of Science. We are currently in discussions with IIT Roorkee, and we have a lot of collaborations with universities outside India. But we are open to see, I mean, if there are areas of common interest, we are open to any geography, any good research institute.
I don't have any question, but I just want to say that TIFR has an infinitesimal role in your drug discovery programs. Glenmark, we have a national facility, NMR facility, and from Glenmark,
yeah.
Girish Budi and
I know,
Kajana,
yes.
Vivedi,
yes.
They keep coming for
structures, I know, yes.
And from the 8 companies which you mentioned, 6 companies have been coming to our facility for their drug discovery programs regularly.
Right, so that's the kind of paid collaboration, let's say, whatever, I don't know the terms of this interaction,
yeah,
but
they don't
it's a paid service.
What they are
absolutely.
Doing, but we help them with what kind of experiments they need to do.
Yes. That's good.
Because
yeah.
I saw those papers, I remember Girish.
Goody. Yeah, he heads our pharmacokinetics department. Yes. Right. So I heard from them also many a times during project meetings that this is being done at TIFR or even IIT Mumbai, I think they often go for similar work, NMR.
So we have an 800 megahertz, so they prefer doing on that high field.
Yes. I think we have one lower version,
yes.
Probably. That's good. Yeah, so there is already interaction. No gap. Gap is reduced. Thank you, my pleasure.